Today is Thursday, August 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, reactions continue to emerge from U.S. President Donald Trump's remark last week about Israel.
In my opinion, you vote for a Democrat, you're being very disloyal to Jewish people, and you're being very disloyal to Israel.
But what are the political implications? Also, South Korea and Japan have scrapped a key military agreement, and the WHO releases a new report on microplastic in water. All these stories and more are next. U.S. President Donald Trump has made a lot of headlines this week. He's canceled a planned trip to Denmark because the country's prime minister made a nasty remark in reaction to his suggestion regarding Greenland. He also said American Jews who vote for Democrats show either a total lack of knowledge or great disloyalty. The president has also announced he's looking to end birthright citizenship, which is enshrined in the Constitution's 14th Amendment. Now, to help unpack the political implications of these statements and more, we're joined at the line by Dr. Richard Himmelfarb, professor of political science at Hofstra University. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess where I want to begin is exactly how do we begin by looking at the political implications of everything that's coming out of the White House this week?
Well, it's a in my assessment, just more of the same. President says something. It sets off this whirlwind of controversy and discussion and pushback, and then defense by him and people loyal to him, and then the dust settles, and we move on to the next controversy. So one thing I can say with certainty is that by next week at this time, we will barely remember this, because there will have been three or four controversies that will have popped up, in between the ones we're discussing now and next week.
So speaking of controversies, Mr. Trump is headed to the G7 coming up this weekend. How does this kind of international focus on what he's saying regarding Denmark, regarding Israel, play into any kind of conversations he may have with other world leaders while meeting with the G7 group?
I don't know that it's going to have much effect. I tend to believe that these leaders look at the United States, and they see us as the great superpower of the world. And regardless of what Trump says or what types of insults he levies against countries or people, these leaders are, for the most part, I think, disciplined enough and sort of mature enough to understand that life goes on even with somebody as sort of volatile and unpredictable as Donald Trump.
Well, these are international questions, but of course, here in the United States, we are in the 2020 presidential election cycle. A lot of the remarks over time that the president has made seem to be geared towards energizing his base. Is this more of the same?
Are you referring to the remarks he made about Jewish people?
Jewish people, as well as the comments about ending birthright citizenship and immigration policies coming out this week.
Well, I think that what you're going to see, beginning maybe a few months ago and going forward, is practically everything that he sends or tweets out is going to be done with an eye towards the 2020 election and energizing the base. I mean, that's how elections work in this country today. Both sides try to energize the base. There aren't that many people who are in the middle, who are really undecided and who could really vote for either party. And so elections are won or lost by energizing the people who are your supporters and getting them angry enough and excited enough to go out and vote.
Dr. Richard Himmelfarb is a political science professor at Hofstra University. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A North Korean spokesman said on Thursday the United States' recent testing of mid-range cruise missiles, along with plans to deploy fighter jets and military equipment around the Korean Peninsula, would trigger a new Cold War in the region. On the government website, the spokesman said that North Korea remains unchanged in its position to resolve all issues through dialogue and negotiation, but dialogue accompanied by military threats is of no use to it. North's stance comes the day after the U.S. envoy to North Korea, Stephen Biegun, said the Trump administration was ready to resume working-level talks on nuclear negotiations following the second summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. In addition, today, South Korea announced it will end an intelligence-sharing pact with Japan, a decision that could further escalate a dispute over history and trade and undercut security cooperation with North Korea. To get a broader picture of the events, I spoke earlier with Mintaro Oba, a U.S. State Department official under the Obama administration. I began our conversation by asking him what he thought the prospects of talks were between the United States and North Korea.
Well, we're at a pivotal moment in U.S.-North Korea diplomacy between a moment of tension caused by the diplomatic impasse we've had so far and U.S.-ROK combined military exercises, and a moment of opportunity created by those exercises ending and the time pressure to get some sort of agreement by the end of the year. So I do see some prospect for diplomacy between the United States and North Korea moving forward in the coming months. But at the same time, I'd caution that the really fundamental issues that brought the two countries to an impasse, such as defining denuclearization or the extent of sanctions relief, have really not been resolved yet.
You mentioned that there is an opportunity. What makes this opportunity different than, say, the last few years of trying to get North Korea to the table to commit to denuclearization, even though that is a term that both sides really haven't agreed to in what it means yet?
Well, I am not sure that this opportunity is different. I have previously characterized the state of U.S.-North Korea relations under the Trump administration as defibrillator diplomacy, in that the process comes close to death at various points throughout the year, and the United States jump-starts it again with a big shock of energy through summit diplomacy, but it hasn't treated the underlying diseases that cause the process to come to the brink of failure again and again. So I would have a lot of concern that the United States remains not flexible enough and not creative enough to really make the most out of any opportunity with North Korea.
If we step back and look at a more regional aspect of it, Seoul has announced that it is going to end the intelligence sharing agreement it has with Tokyo. What do you see as the implications of that agreement coming to an end?
Well, first of all, there are the practical implications that South Korea and Japan will no longer be able to share critical intelligence regarding North Korean missiles and other key security considerations directly. But more broadly, it sets an extremely dangerous precedent because previously, for many years, Korea and Japan had to count on the fact that the security relationship between the two countries would be shielded from bilateral political tensions and treated more pragmatically than other areas of the relationship. And this marks a real turning point, and it sets a precedent that, you know, security cooperation can be held hostage to broader tensions.
Hasn't that always been the case between Seoul and Tokyo? If we take a look at this agreement that is coming to an end, it was going to go into place several years ago during the Imanbak administration, but when he visited Dokdo, which is a disputed territory that Japan also claims as Takashima, that deal was scrapped. So is the politicalization of these type of agreement anything new?
Well, that's a great point. I think this particular agreement has been so high profile that it has always contained some sort of political elements, but the United States has worked hard to make trilateral security cooperation very pragmatic. Scrapping this JSOMIA agreement now really hampers the progress that we have made in the last few years.
Mintaro Oba is a former U.S. State Department official under the Obama administration joining us on the phone today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
France joined Germany on Thursday in challenging British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to show he can come up with a better alternative to the main sticking point in the stalled Brexit negotiations, giving him a month to prove that he can break the deadlock on the Irish border question.
It is vital for trust in politics, that if you have a referendum, then you should act on the instructions of the voters. And that is why we must come out of the EU on October the 31st, deal or no deal.
Johnson tried to exude confidence and charm in Paris as he pressed French President Emmanuel Macron to accept his request to reopen Brexit negotiations. Macron reiterated that the EU has been, what the EU has been saying for months, that it won't reopen the Brexit divorce deal negotiated with Britain's previous Prime Minister, Theresa May. The sticky point remains the question of the Republic of Ireland and its border with Northern Ireland, which is part of the United Kingdom. Border checkpoints there were a flashpoint for sectarian violence in the past, and some fear their reintroduction could damage the hard-won peace in Northern Ireland. Among other top stories in the world, the death toll from a suicide bomb attack at a wedding at an Afghan capital last week has risen to 80. Survivors said hundreds of guests were inside the hall when the blast occurred near the stage where the musicians were playing. A fresh push to repatriate Rohingya refugees to Myanmar appeared Thursday to fall flat with no one turning up to get on 5 buses and 10 trucks arranged by Bangladesh. Australia is seeing an increase in interest in its millionaire-only visa program from wealthy Hong Kong residents who are eyeing a safety net amid political turmoil in the Chinese-ruled territory. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our mobile app. This is VOA News.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Iranian state media reported on Thursday that Tehran displayed what it described as a domestically built long-range mobile surface-to-air missile. Reuters reporter Megan Revelle has those details.
Iran has displayed what it describes as a domestically built long-range missile defense system. State TV released footage on Thursday showing President Hassan Rouhani at the unveiling ceremony for the Bavar 373 system. The announcement comes amid rising tension with the United States. Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone in the Gulf with a surface-to-air missile in June, saying it was over its territory. But the U.S. insists the drone was in international airspace. Iran has developed a large domestic arms industry in the face of international sanctions and embargoes. Western analysts say Iran often exaggerates its weapon capabilities, but there are still strong concerns about its long-range ballistic missile program.
And that was Reuters reporter Megan Revelle. Coal has powered progress since the Industrial Revolution. While coal-fired power is on the rise in Asia, it's declining in the United States and much of Europe as cheaper alternatives and climate concerns push it out of the market. While the fall in coal demand has hit mining towns hard in the Appalachian regions of the eastern United States, the western state of Wyoming is the nation's leading coal producer. VOA's Steve Barragona reports that now coal's troubles have arrived in this energy-rich state as well.
The colossal mines of Wyoming's Powder River Basin ship some of the cheapest coal in the country to power plants from Georgia to Oregon. As coal-fired power has lost ground to natural gas and renewables, companies with mines here still felt secure, says University of Wyoming economist Robert Godby.
Those companies were seen to have jewels in their balance sheets because the Powder River Basin was so profitable. But that's changed in a few short years.
This year, two Wyoming coal companies went bankrupt.
The gates went down, they pulled everybody off. And that is a really sobering moment because it is the thing they said would never happen, and it happened.
Melissa Peterson-Worden worked for Black Jewel, the second of the two failed companies. Black Jewel's messy bankruptcy has disrupted her life and the lives of about 600 others.
Oh, we're struggling. We're struggling. We're holding on. Our big one is the house payment. Hi, girls.
Former Black Jewel miner Rory Wallet says until now, working in the mines has been a good job with good pay and benefits.
It's a wonderful way to make a living, a decent, livable living. I've got four kids, so it's a great way to keep them insured, keep food on the table, keep a good home over their head.
Coal has built the city as you see it, I feel, with the royalties and property tax and sales tax.
Louise Carter King is mayor of Gillette, Wyoming, home to two Black Jewel mines and several others. She says the city has to find new industries, and she has high hopes for the new integrated test center nearby. Next year, competitors from the Carbon XPRIZE will plug in to the coal-fired power plant's exhaust to find ways to capture and make products from the plant's carbon dioxide.
Even though there's just one winner for the $10 million prize, the other four won't be bad, you know, and so we're hoping some of the, you know, one of those industries or more could stay here.
Many scientists consider carbon capture essential to fighting climate change, but it's years off at best. In the meantime, Rory Wallet says recent events have shaken his faith in coal, but not by much.
I'd lie if I said it didn't. I plan on hanging on. If I don't get a coal job immediately, I'll keep looking in the basin. They're always available. It really is part of family and part of life. It's something I love doing.
But there's a growing sense in Gillette that coal will not be here forever.
That is the big question. What's next? And pardon the pun, Gillette needs to dig deep to figure out what next is. The United States is saying, what do you have for us now? And we have to come up with a better answer than, if you don't like coal, don't turn your lights on. We can't be those people anymore.
It's an uncertain future for a city and an industry in transition. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Gillette, Wyoming.
Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro said today that the government lacks the resources to fight wildfires in the Amazon rainforest after satellite images showed a record number of burning spots this year. In a speech broadcast live on Facebook, the president said the government is investigating the fires. He also said that he never claimed non-governmental organizations were starting fires in the forest, saying he was only talking of his suspicions. Brazil's National Institute for Space Research, which monitors deforestation and wildfires, said more than 74,000 wildfires have been detected so far this year in the Amazon rainforest, an 84% increase from the same period last year. You're listening to VOA News.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Microplastics contained in drinking water pose a low risk to human health at current levels, but more research is needed to reassure consumers, according to a new report by the World Health Organization. Reuters' Grace Lee has that story.
It's not visible to the naked eye, but this cup of water contains microplastics. You're potentially ingesting these microplastics every day, though, according to the World Health Organization, it's nothing to worry about yet.
Well, after having reviewed all the data, I think our message is one of reassurance to potentially worried consumers and that the health risks that were assessed to be low.
On Thursday, the organization released its first report on potential health risks associated with ingesting microplastics. There is limited data, they say, but so far, that data has been reassuring.
The main message is that the vast majority of microplastics would pass harmlessly through the body.
According to the environmental charity WWF International, plastic pollution has become so widespread in the environment that you could be ingesting 5 grams a week, the equivalent of eating a credit card. A large source of that comes from drinking water. But the WHO says there's a bigger problem when it comes to health threats in water.
Well, right now, there's 2 billion people in the world that are drinking fecally contaminated water, which is a staggering number. And there is almost 1 million deaths per year.
That can lead to diseases that cause diarrhea and even death, especially in poor countries lacking water treatment systems.
So that's really what people need to focus on, especially in Africa and South Asia and places where there's insufficient or inadequate water supply and sanitation.
And that was Reuters reporter Grace Lee. A 3-year study by 13 leading malaria and public health experts finds malaria eradication is feasible, but it will take new tools, political commitment, and lots of money to achieve it. Lisa Schlein has those details.
The concept of malaria eradication is not new. It has been around since the mid-1950s, when the World Health Organization launched its first global malaria eradication plan. Though that and subsequent efforts have failed to rid the world of the deadly, debilitating disease, experts say malaria eradication is feasible. They say there is no biological barrier to its elimination. The director of the WHO's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, says achieving that goal would involve improving primary health care and access to services, and better use of data and surveillance systems. But the key to eradicating malaria, he says, is accelerated research and development of new tools.
We need a re-energized research and development effort to develop the knowledge base, the strategies, and the tools, be these vector control tools, drugs, improved vaccines, or other technologies, that will allow us to walk the last mile or even accelerate our road to eradication.
Global malaria infection and death rates have remained virtually unchanged since 2015. The World Health Organization reports every year some 200 million people are infected with malaria and about 400,000 die. It says more than 90% of those deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa. Children are the biggest victims. Health experts say eradicating malaria would both save lives and boost economies, but that takes political commitment and money. The WHO estimates the cost of scaling up current malaria intervention until 2030 at $34 billion. The agency says the return on that investment would be huge. It says the strategy the money buys would save 4 million lives over the next 11 years and would prevent 2 billion people from being infected with malaria. The economic gain, it says, would be roughly $283 billion in total gross domestic product. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, engineer Sidrak Franklin, and managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll find in-depth coverage of world events and news at voanews.com. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download the stories and take them with you anytime, day or night, as you wish. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Make it a great day.